Welcome to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Republicans and Democrats, are you ready to cast your ballot for governor? Can you believe absentee ballots are about to go out in the mail? And the Florida primary is just over a month away, Tom. It's right around the corner. Now, earlier this week, the five Democrats running for governor met for the first time on a debate stage in Fort Myers. At the same time, the two Republicans in the race scrapped their plans to meet for a debate because one of them, Congressman Ron DeSantis, he decided to do an appearance with Donald Trump Jr. in Longwood, Florida, rather than debate his opponent in the race, Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam. So no debate for the Republicans because of that.
That's right. And in fact, there may be a presidential visit later on this month, just as the absentee ballots go out in support of Congressman DeSantis's efforts to secure the Republican nomination for governor here in Florida. So, yeah, you know, we are getting very close to primary day. And if you take a look at your mailbox, the snail mail flyers that are coming and jamming into there from politicians, of course, the television ads and the radio ads and commercial radio, even the online ads, all of that has stepped up as the candidates are stepping up their spending in this closed primary state. You have to be registered as a Democrat or Republican in order to make a choice in those partisan primaries coming up in late August. So that's where we'll begin this week here on the Florida Roundup statewide edition. Are you ready to vote? What kinds of questions do you have for the candidates? Who is bending your ear? Who is annoying you, for that matter, with their campaign message? How about that? 305-995-1800 across the state of Florida. Lots of politics here as the summer is heating up in the Sunshine State. So is the political rhetoric. A.G. Gankarski is back with us of Florida Politics, following the governor's race closely, and joins us now. The spending here, A.G., in just the last couple of weeks is stepped up considerably, and I got to think is going to be at a fever pitch as we move into early voting in about a month or so.
Right. It's really starting to pick up on both sides of the aisle. Republicans, Adam Putnam, Ron DeSantis are spending big. They're trying to get that primary nomination. But on the Democratic side, Jeff Green, he just got in a race a few weeks ago, right before the qualifying deadline. He is up on TV everywhere in the state, and he's willing to spend what it takes. He's got $2.3 billion that we know about, and he's willing to spend a big chunk of that. Philip Levine's on TV. Gwen Graham has got some television up. Everybody but Andrew Gillum basically is on television on the Democratic side. So we're going to see this escalate as we get to the end of August.
Yeah, Green, it's being reported just today that he put $10 million of his own money into his campaign in less than a month. Philip Levine, the former Miami Beach mayor, also willing to spend millions of his own money. And on the Republican side, your website, Florida Politics, is talking about how a group backed by the Koch brothers has put a lot of money into the campaign of Ron DeSantis, in particular a direct mail campaign. As Tom was just saying, we're all going to be getting those flyers in our mailboxes, the robocalls, the barrage of television ads. It's that season, and you really almost can't escape it. Now, you mentioned the only candidate on the Democratic side that isn't a millionaire is Andrew Gillum, the mayor of Tallahassee. As Tom pointed out, the Democrats all debated Wednesday night in Fort Myers. Wink TV carried that debate. We're going to listen to a couple of the comments from the Democrats. Here's Gillum stressing his humble roots in his race for the gubernatorial nomination.
I'm on this stage running for anybody who has ever been told that they don't belong, that they don't come from the right family, don't have a deep enough bank account. I'm here for those of us who are living the everyday experience trying to learn to survive and thrive in this state. And it is my condition that we deserve a seat at the table, too.
Okay, so Andrew Gillum really stressing that working man appeal. Out of all the candidates in the race, he's probably the one that can most truly claim that as a guy who's not rolling in money. He's not getting, though, the name recognition and the polling numbers that some of his opponents have gotten.
Exactly. You have to buy TV to get the name recognition. That's how Jeff Green got to the top of polls already, just with those ads. Gillum makes about $150,000 a year, about half of that from being mayor of Tallahassee, the other half from being a consultant. What Gillum does have is money from George Soros and Tom Steyer. They've made commitments already, $1.75 million. More money could come in. Will it be enough to get Gillum on TV? That's the question. Grassroots can only take you so far.
But there's a lot of Gillum's campaign has bet big in grassroots. I mean, in part because that's where they can spend those dollars they think effectively. But what about that messaging, the progressive messaging that he and his supporters have really emphasized here, looking at income disparity, looking at education spending? How is that messaging, do you think, AG, resonating or not, as the case may be, in the Democratic base as they look to try to excite that in obviously what's a pretty crowded field for the August contest?
Right. Gillum gets the rock star reactions wherever he goes. If he's coming to Jacksonville or Orlando or Miami, he's packing a church, he's packing a hall, and people want to hear the stuff that Gillum is saying.
But doesn't that go to say the return on investment on the grassroots seems to be paying off then? Because they're getting people into those events, at least.
It is, but it's not translating in the polls,
yeah.
and that's really the issue. If you're running third or fourth in polls consistently, you're not able to translate that base enthusiasm into voters. I mean, the people turn out for events aren't necessarily all the likely voters. Some people are just watching TV and seeing the candidates that way.
Yeah. So many voters on both sides still undecided, by the way. And here's our question to callers. Have you made up your mind? Who will you vote for if you're voting in the August primary for Florida governor and, you know, other races, too? The deadline to register is at the end of this month. So if you haven't registered, register and give us a call at 305-995-1800. Now, let's talk about another candidate in the race, the only woman running for governor, Gwen Graham, and her candidacy. Take a listen to Graham from Wednesday night.
Now, you may notice I look a little different than my other friends up here on stage. I'm a mom, former PTA president, public school official, and I served Florida in Congress. And it is these life experiences that make me uniquely qualified to be the next governor of Florida.
Okay, Gwen Graham running, leading with her candidacy as a mom, as a woman, as a moderate Democrat who represented a panhandle district, AG, and she's really coming out hard now. In terms of the abortion issue, she is campaigning around the state saying if Roe versus Wade is overturned, abortion will be illegal in Florida within 18 months. Is this the type of wedge issue that Graham can use to break out in this crowded field? And will it turn out, do you think, female voters? Will this issue be a defining issue in this primary?
Well, she got the Emily's List backing months ago, and you know, with what's happening in the federal level, it is a concern for women. Reproductive rights, human rights for, you know, women in general are a major concern. And Graham is uniquely qualified to carry that issue. And also with people getting to the left over and other issues, it makes sense that she's going to play that card. She's going to hit that issue and see where it goes. I mean, is it going to get her above the, you know, the field in the primary? That remains to be seen. She's got a lot of institutional support from Democrats. She's gotten a lot of endorsements, but so far she hasn't really been able to put away that, you know, become the front runner that everybody expected a year ago.
And even after the Supreme Court nominee from the president that obviously brought the attention to the abortion issue in the states, including here in Florida, Melissa, as you mentioned, and AG, you know, that's among the things that's kind of interesting here. Obviously a crowded field in the Democrats, but it's a crowded issue. Crowded field for issues here. You know, you've got the toxic algae that has been in the headlines. We've talked about that over the past several months, of course. Gun safety issues and school spending on the heels of the Parkland tragedy back in February. That continues to be obviously a very active issue for folks. Abortion is kind of on that agenda because of the Supreme Court nomination, but has it floated up in your estimation or any polling to a place where that is something that voters are going to make a decision, are going to base a decision on coming up in August, let alone in November?
Well, I haven't seen the messaging above normal levels on that from any of the candidates yet on the Democratic side, which tells me that their pollsters are telling them that it's not the number one driving issue right now, rhetoric notwithstanding. I mean, you do have the environmental issues. You have all of the things that Rick Scott was responsible for the last 8 years.
Yeah.
And every Democrat obviously stands in opposition.
And let me just jump in and say, Philip Levine, the former Miami Beach mayor, more than any of these other candidates, is really running on opposing Rick Scott's record as governor. And during the debate, he hit upon several of those points. Here's Levine.
We have these algae blooms and environmental issues and a sea that's rising all over the state. We have a minimum living wage, which is way too low to live on. Many folks in Florida, 1.6 million, don't have health insurance. I have a baby boy, two additional children. I'm running so that they have a shot at the Florida and the American dream. I'm running for governor so that everybody in Florida can have a shot at the American dream.
Okay, so Levine's saying we're going to do the exact opposite of what Rick Scott did. All the Democrats basically are saying that. So for the Republicans, Adam Putnam and Ron DeSantis, they're asking the voters for 4 more years of Republican control of the governor's mansion, a very different challenge before them. And we see DeSantis in the latest polling breaking away from Putnam based, it would seem, upon his close relationship with President Trump and Trump's endorsement of DeSantis. That's working for DeSantis in the primary. We'll see if it works for him in the general, if he gets the nomination.
Right. I mean, this primary election Republican side has been federalized. State issues have not really been discussed
right.
as much as, you know, who likes Donald Trump more. And, you know, Putnam, you know, clings to Trump, but DeSantis has Trump's son coming in, people from Fox News coming in. Donald Trump's going to come in himself. And Adam Putnam's been on record saying disparaging things about Donald Trump that, you know, the president will quote when he's in Florida. And that's going to be very hard for Putnam to overcome. You know, Putnam can't just say he changed his mind when Donald Trump's at a rally stage, you know, doing what Donald Trump does best, which is basically Catskill-style insults of political opponents. It's going to be brutal. So, I mean, DeSantis right now is the front runner.
Catskill-style insults. Anyone who's seen Dirty Dancing might get that reference,
by the way. Yeah, yet another import from the Northeast into Florida, right?
Yeah, how about it?
305-995-1800, the gubernatorial campaign on the Republican side, lots of heated rhetoric, lots of money being spent in the Democratic side. What is gaining your attention or solidifying your support and your vote? 305-995-1800. Let's take our first call here from West Palm Beach in South Florida. Anthony on line one. Go ahead, Anthony. You're on the air.
Yes. On the Republican side, I think we have candidate bad and candidate worse. So I'm looking to the Democrats to get us somebody new. I really like Mr. Killam. I believe he'd make a great governor, and I plan to vote for him, but I'm really nervous about two things. One is, can he win the nomination, and then can he win the race? And so I may have to go with Gwen or Alex Levine, because I don't want Jeff Green, and I don't want either one of the Republicans.
So it sounds, Anthony, like you haven't made up your mind yet.
Well, I've made up my mind who I want to vote for. I'm not sure who I'm going to have to vote for.
All right. So Anthony's ballot is down to three names on the Democratic side, it sounds like.
Right.
But what about that electability issue? I mean, that may dog any one of the Democrats here, given the Republican stronghold on statewide office in Florida.
Right. The electability issue is going to be key as voters decide who are going to support. I mean, Gillum has not led in any polls except for one from Gravis, which was a questionable poll. You know, Chris King is around 3% in these polls. So you have to wonder if those supporters are going to decide to go with Graham or go with Levine. You know, there's the idea of stopping somebody like Jeff Green, who's been questioned for his ideological purity. So, yeah, I mean, these are the things that always happen when you have crowded primaries, as people decide who they don't want as much as who they want.
They try to be strategic. So for Democrats like that caller, you hear them mulling over their choices, thinking strategically. The Republican primary electorate is a very different mindset right now, as you pointed out. it's all about Donald Trump.
Right.
And whether or not you are with the president.
Right. I mean, the people who are going to decide the Republican primary are older white super voters, people who are 50 and over. They vote in every election. They like President Trump. They might have the red MAGA hats. And, you know, really, it's going to be the Trump primary. And that's what DeSantis has bet on since before he got in a race. He was messaging on this in 2017, you know, letting Putnam go through the paces.
And lots of calls coming into the Florida Roundup. Let's go to Kitty in Oakland Park. Hi, Kitty. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for having this conversation. I have two comments. One is that I am a progressive Democrat, and I'm undecided about who to vote for in the primary because I'm only concerned about who can beat a Republican in November. My other comment is about Lynn Graham's messaging around the abortion issue. It is absolutely key because it indicates lots of things about the state of our country and how we treat people and women specifically. But also what she needs to do is get her messaging together because it doesn't specifically say that or translate into the fact that we will see back alley abortions and dead women.
So is that a defining issue for you in this race, Kitty?
Well, I feel that voting blue, you're pretty good, you know, to understanding that we need to keep pro-choice at the forefront of our voting concerns and of our values. What I don't think, though, is that people lack a connection to what else that means regarding our rights for everyone. So people think it's a woman's issue. They're not as concerned about it, especially a male candidate doesn't really talk about it. And it's really a shame that nobody is connecting this messaging to understand what this means for everybody.
Gotcha. Okay. So that's an interesting point to make, too. Wherever you fall on the issue of abortion, AG, for that voter, it's a human rights issue.
Right. And I think third-party groups are going to be the people who push that messaging in the fall during the general election if Graham gets there. Gwen Graham's brand is not, you know, pushing harsh rhetoric. She hugs people generally. She likes photo ops where she looks sunny and positive. I don't know if she has that gear, but I can tell you that third-party groups on her behalf will have that gear and will make that case clear.
I want to return back to this electability issue because Kitty brings up some really interesting points, I think, considering the abortion issue and messaging from the only female in the race for governor and how, for Kitty, the abortion issue stretches across genders and that it's not a women's issue. It's a voting issue. But her first thought about, I'm interested in, Kitty's interested in a Democrat who can win. This gets, again, back to this electability issue. And as you look at that field of five Democrats, AG, what's your sense of how registered Democrats who will vote in a primary are essentially measuring up these five in electability?
Well, the electability question, I mean, when you look at polls right now, Graham is a little ahead of some others. But, you know, when you look at, you know, the whole field, a lot happens in a race to define these candidates. We still haven't seen hurricanes. We haven't seen other things. So there's a lot of ball to be played.
There's going to be a surprise.
Hope we don't, AG.
There will be many surprises.
Yeah, we got more to come. 305-995-1800 here. 305-995-1800 statewide here on the Florida Roundup. Talking about politics and more of your phone calls and thoughts to come after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Lots of calls on the Florida Roundup. Who will get your vote in the governor's race? The primary is just a few weeks away. Let's go to Eric. He's in Jacksonville. Hey, Eric, you're on the air. How are you?
Hey, guys. I'm doing well. Thank you. 2 points really quick. I think as far as the Supreme Court nomination that Trump is about to make with the Republican Party is the old be careful what you wish for. And I'll put another adage on there. What does the dog do when he catches the car? When he actually catches the car? I mean, if they try to repeal Roe v. Wade, I just don't think they'll be able to pull that off. And so I think that they have to be careful about. They have to tiptoe through this, in my opinion. The second thing is about sort of the techniques of the Republican Party. You notice that the Bill Nelson ads, I've noticed that basically one message you're getting from the Republican Party in those ads is don't vote for Bill Nelson because he's a partisan. And this is a very clever way to, paint Bill Nelson in a bad light. But I would take the exact opposite. I would embrace that, and I would say vote for Bill Nelson because he's a partisan. There are really big differences between these two parties. One party wants to raise the minimum wage, one party doesn't. One party wants everybody to have health care, one party doesn't. One party wants to raise taxes on the very wealthy to return our tax policies to the way they used to be. One party doesn't. So there are real differences between these parties. And my advice to anyone listening, for whatever it's worth, I'm just a guy with a phone after all, is to vote Democrat down the line and don't worry about the personalities. Don't worry about what a person looks like. Don't worry about their haircut. Don't worry about their religion. Just vote D down the line and ignore all the other nonsense.
Thanks, Eric. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of enthusiasm on the Democratic side, AG. Democrats are fired up to vote, largely driven by, not completely driven by, but largely driven by their opposition to President Donald Trump. Okay, so will that translate in this primary? And are Republicans going to be equally fired up to support candidates like Rick Scott, by the way, who, of course, is leaving the governor's mansion? And he's in this tight contest with Bill Nelson as Nelson tries to hang on to his Senate seat.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. I don't know if it's going to translate in primary turnout in the same way. I don't know if that's necessarily correlative. But when you look at, Rick Scott and Bill Nelson, I mean, Rick Scott's on TV all the time between, his campaign and a third party group supporting him. And they're making that point about Bill Nelson all the time. Where's Bill Nelson on the airwaves? He's absent. You see the same thing with Hispanic voters. Rick Scott is making inroads that nobody would have predicted because he, would go to Puerto Rico, he'd meet with the governor, he would do these things, be very visible about it. And, Rick Scott is actually expanding the Republican coalition. He's not getting as close to Donald Trump as people thought he might when Trump came into office. I mean, Rick Scott is very careful about not endorsing everything Donald Trump does. Yeah. It's a very calibrated message. It's going to be a little bit different than it might have looked a few months ago in terms of, the blue wave.
AG, how do you mean that Rick Scott is expanding the Republican coalition? I mean, even that phrase, Republican coalition, is kind of an interesting one, but you mean just the Trump core voter in Florida and expanding it beyond that?
I think it's expanded beyond that. And I think you look at Central Florida, South Florida, the Puerto Ricans who moved over in the wake of the hurricane last year. Mm-hmm. Many of them are supporting Republicans, at least Rick Scott. And, that's key. Will that have an effect down ticket? That remains to be seen.
Yeah.
But the fact is Rick Scott has been very smart with his political maneuvers in the last couple of years.
AG Gankarski is along with us, Florida Politics. I'm Tom Hudson, my colleague in Jacksonville, Melissa Ross. Your phone calls, 305-995-1800. Lots of good ones here, so let's get to them, continuing in South Florida, in Miami. Nicholas on line four. Let me punch you up there. Go ahead, Nicholas. You're on the radio.
Hi, yes, I'm Nicholas de Cordova. I'm a big fan of y'all's show. I would just like to say that I'm a fairly liberal, independent millennial who will be willing to vote for a pro-life Democrat, but I would not be willing to vote for a pro-choice Democrat. Also, I like Rick Scott a bit because of the way he handled the hurricane.
Based on that, then, I think all the Democrats running this cycle are pro-choice, so that doesn't leave you a Democrat to vote for, I don't believe.
Will that
change your vote?
Yeah, that will. I cannot in good conscience vote for somebody who is pro-choice. But I might not end up voting if that's the case, if I can't find a Republican that I like.
Are you registered as with one of the parties? You describe yourself as a liberal independent. You're not going to have much of a ballot in August if you go into your polling place with that.
Let me restate that. I would describe myself as a moderate independent. I am registered. I do swing slightly to the right, and I am registered as a Republican. But I didn't vote for any of. I didn't vote in the last election, and I'm not. I couldn't vote for Trump in good conscience.
Okay.
And I would definitely describe myself like maybe libertarian, because socially I'm very liberal.
Gotcha.
Except for my pro-life.
But in Florida, registered as a Republican. Issue. Yeah. Thanks, Nicholas. Appreciate that phone call.
And, you know, this again shows the enduring power of abortion as a wedge issue in politics, AG. We're seeing that play out right here in Florida.
Right. And that voter obviously is going to have an existential challenge when he gets into the polling place. But what he did is he illustrated the issue with turnout for millennials, with younger voters. They're not willing to go in and choose the lesser of two evils. If they don't like somebody on the ballot, they stay home. And, well, that sounds principled and thoughtful. What that does is it, you know, if you look at it over a whole class of millennials, it disenfranchises people. It leads older people to decide the elections, and, you know, they're willing to pick between two candidates they don't necessarily agree with 100% of the time.
305-995-1800 to join the Florida Roundup. Robert is in Jacksonville. Hey, Robert, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you? Okay. Yes, I also believe in women's rights, including unborn women's rights, and therefore I'm pro-life. And I am voting for Ron DeSantis because I have seen him mention that he is pro-life in his ads. And just like a previous caller said, he wanted everybody to vote for people with D's by their name. I would like for this November for people to vote with R's by their name. But I am for Ron DeSantis.
Okay, and so you would not vote for Adam Putnam, even though I'm reasonably certain he's also pro-life. So is there any other reason why you're going for DeSantis?
I'm going for DeSantis because of right now all the ads I've seen, he's mentioned that he's pro-life, and Adam Putnam has not.
Okay.
But I could be swayed. I can truly
you could be
swayed.
Yes.
Yeah, still time for Robert's vote there, it sounds like.
Yeah, this issue just arouses such passions that it's just fascinating to me to see how it's playing right here in the governor's race as the Supreme Court fight is going to play out.
In this, this really wasn't on, I mean, high on the list of voter issues back in April and May. Obviously, the Supreme Court nomination really has put it in play, in part because of the kinds of state laws and the debate that we've had in the legislature over session after session regarding access to health care and access to abortion rights as well. Pembroke Pines in Broward County, South Florida. Joanne is up next on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead, Joanne. You're on the radio.
Hi. I just don't think that men should be deciding what women can do with their own bodies. I think it's up to women. And I think this whole thing about pro-choice, women should be able to decide for themselves. I don't agree with men deciding.
Joanne, what does that mean for your vote, assuming you're going to vote in the primary election? Well, will you vote in August?
Yes, and I'll vote for a Democrat.
Will you vote for the only woman in the race, Gwen Graham, who's really campaigning on this issue?
Not necessarily, because they're all pro-choice.
So thanks for that, Joanne. So Graham then really hitting this issue hard, it may not necessarily translate to more female votes for her from pro-choice women, because all of the Democrats are going to say the Democratic Party line on this issue, that they support a woman's white right to choose.
Exactly. They're all going to virtue signal on that one for the base. You know, Graham has hit hard. She said Gwen and the men so many times. Yeah. It's her against a field of men. But, you know, I think there's diminishing returns in that approach. You know, if that's your sole approach and that you're a male voter voting for a Democrat, you might look a different way. But, yeah, you don't see a lot of ideological divergence in either field in the primary election.
The party platforms have become extremely we are talking as polarized as we've been in this country since in many decades. On any issue you care to name, the parties are farther apart than they've been in quite some time. Let's go to Tamara in Broward County now. Tamara, hello.
Hi, good afternoon.
Go ahead.
I wanted to just wanted everybody to be mindful of the fact that Florida is a closed primary state. And so those who are, you know, independents or non-party affiliated, they should really think about picking a party, listening to what the callers are saying, picking a party, and, you know, not complaining when their candidate didn't get selected. I just wanted to reiterate that and wanted everyone to be mindful.
Yeah, thanks for that. And, you know, it's funny, guys, because I've had a few people say to me, both Republicans and Democrats, you know, I had been MPA for years, but this midterm election has got me so riled up that I'm going back to re-register to be in a party so that I can cast a ballot this August. I don't know how widespread that is, but feelings are running pretty high. People are actively taking steps to do that in some cases.
Right. But, you know, candidates, except for Andrew Gillum, aren't really doing voter registration drives in some way. Gillum's strategy has been to expand that universe of voters.
Yep.
The other four Democrats have kind of left it status quo and hoping it would take care of itself.
And that strategy is especially through the Next Gen project and trying to register younger voters, especially the 18, 19, 20, 21, 22-year-old voters that are on college campuses. And as they come back, it'll be after or right before the primary, but after the deadline to register to vote in order to be in that primary. A couple more calls here in Mayport. Mark has been patient. Go ahead, Mark. You're on the radio.
Hey, good Friday to you.
Love the energy, Mark. Hit it.
Hey. Listen, speaking of disenfranchised, this closed primary system makes me feel like I don't really get to select the candidates that I want. So I, for the last couple of years, have started with trying to get rid of Angela Corey. I switched over to the opposition party with registration so I could kind of have a choice in the primaries to pick the guy I wanted to run again. And maybe if more Democrats did that, we could get the candidates we want to run again.
You know, it's interesting because here's a state with a really, thanks for that call, Mark. Mark out in Mayport. We've got a state, and we're going to talk to a supervisor of elections official in a moment here on the show about some of these issues, but we've got a state AG with, what's the number now of non-party affiliated voters in Florida? It's about a third of the voters.
Yeah, it's about a Neapolitan split there.
Yeah, and so they're completely cut out of this primary, this huge chunk in this huge swing state. It's remarkable.
Right. It is. And, you know, but this is the thing. If you want to get involved in party politics, you have to take the good and the bad. I mean, Republicans have their issues. Democrats have their issues. You know, but sitting on the sidelines, if you want to have a, you know, make a point regarding a candidate, you can't really do that. You have to get involved in the primary process one way or the other.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition from Florida Public Radio.
Florida, Melissa, has a big infusion of federal money now to help ensure that your vote is secure. This week, the state accepted $19 million from the federal government to increase election security.
Yeah, it's up now to county election supervisors as to how to spend the money by November. Each county in Florida will get at least $50,000 on election security protection efforts. If the counties don't spend that money by November, it could go back to the state. And that's a timeline some complain is just too tight. But Florida Secretary of State Ken Detzner says he's just following the federal strings attached to the money.
Now, we're following the requirements of the Elections Assistance Commission and their guidelines, their general guidelines as to what is an appropriate expenditure of money. And we tried to do that with some flexibility. We've been talking about this for over a year and a half. Supervisors did surveys as to what their vulnerabilities were, and they well should know what they might be able to use the money for to secure their elections.
Now, the League of Women Voters of Florida wants the spending deadline extended until December by at least another month. All of this, of course, comes as Florida has been targeted by election hackers in the past. A Tallahassee-based election firm was targeted by Russian hackers in 2016 as part of that country's efforts to influence the presidential campaign here. And Florida has been named one of the 18 most vulnerable states to election hacking. That, according to a report from the Democratic members of the Committee on House Administration, it's a congressional committee that oversees federal elections. So those absentee ballots will be in the mail in a matter of days, if not a few weeks. And you've got early voting happening in a few weeks. And of course, the primary in August and the general election in November. So what worries you about your vote? Is it secure? Some voting machines in Florida do not leave a paper trail. 305-995-1800 across the state is our phone number.
And let's go now to Chris Chambliss. He's the Clay County Supervisor of Elections and joins us here at the WJCT studios in Jacksonville. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So what are your initial thoughts about this infusion of federal money you and your other county supervisors are going to receive? How important is this, and how will the funds be used?
I think it's very important that not only that we received the $19 million as a part of the $380 million, but also earlier the Florida legislature through the governor's budget provided $2 million, and that was specifically for Albert systems.
What are those systems?
Albert system is an intrusion detection system, and why that's so important is because an independent county can recognize or notice a specific threat to their network. But now with all supervisors being a part of that intrusion detection, we can see trends and faster act on that information.
And we know that some counties in Florida were targeted in 2016. Secretary of State Ken Dessner won't say which counties those were. So voters are sort of in the dark about whether or not their vote might have been targeted, compromised. How confident can voters really be when we go to the polls this August and this November that Russian hackers aren't going to be messing around again in your systems, that you will be able to keep them out?
Well, first and foremost, let me set the record straight. There was no penetration into any Florida networks with regards to tabulation. Tabulation networks are not connected to the internet. They are closed systems, never connected to the internet. And so the tabulation of a vote was never in question. I believe if we were talking to the suspected intrusion that happened in 2016 was through malware that was sent via email to a number of counties in the state of Florida. However, once again, I know of no email that was opened with that malware attached to. Most counties' systems offloaded that to a filter and was inaccessible to county staff. And so where I believe that the likeliness of, you know, potential threats, we've seen in Tennessee, in Knox County, Tennessee.
Yeah, several states. And we're going to take a quick break here on the Florida Roundup and keep talking about your safe vote after this.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition, talking a lot of politics in the Sunshine State this hour. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville, and we're continuing our conversation with Chris Chambliss, Clay County Supervisor of Elections. Do you have concerns about the security of your vote in light of those indictments of Russian hackers of our nationwide voter systems? According to Chris, here in Florida, there was no penetration, and you were finishing up another thought, and we'll go to some calls, Chris, after you finish what you were saying right before the break. But some other states you pointed to as other examples of this. Tennessee, I think you said, in particular. What happened in Tennessee?
Knox County, Tennessee was a distributed denial of service attempt on election night reporting. And so I think that was where a number of computers flooded with requests in an election night reporting server, which gives the appearance of something that's wrong. And I believe that those threats are faced in any area of business and operation, and elections is no different.
Let's go to Jack in Fernandina Beach. He's got a question about election security in Florida. Hey, Jack, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
I have two questions. Number one, my wife and I moved to Florida in July of last year. Living in Georgia almost all of our grown life, we know the politics there. And I was just wondering, could you give me some sources of information that I could look at or, you know, read about the candidates, where they stand, and all that? And secondly, in Georgia, we had open primaries, and I think if Florida considered it, I would be strongly in favor of it.
Yeah, I think a lot of voters would be as well, Jack. Okay, what about that question, A.G. Gankarski?
About the open primaries question, I don't think that's going to happen. It's not in either party's interest to do so.
Yeah. What about his as a new voter, he wants to research the candidates. Where's the easiest place to do that?
Well, there are websites, Politico Florida, Florida Politics. Those are two go-to state websites. You just basically, you know, need to follow their quotes, follow their fundraising, see where their money is coming from, because a candidate can say anything in an ad, but the reality is the donors are really affecting the candidate's positions.
You look for the places where there's accountability reporting, Jack, and I'd include in the list, AG, your local public radio station in the state of
there
Florida
you go.
As well. A little self-interest
and,
there. But I'm wondering how Chris would answer that question as well, given the election of supervisors, a nonpartisan question there. Where does a voter go for candidate information, Chris?
Well, first and foremost, I believe public libraries and looking at the various periodicals over the length of time to where there's been stories done. Again, I think that you just can't take a particular snapshot for while the race is continuing, but you have to go and look it through the time period of that individual, really, where they stand.
Let me ask you as a follow-up, Chris. We've been talking about how election-related systems in at least 21 states were targeted ahead of the 2016 election. More recently, just this week, an executive at Microsoft also disclosed that Microsoft had identified and helped thwart hacking attempts on three congressional candidates earlier this year. So as that is reported, at the same time just yesterday, we saw the DNI chief, Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, being interviewed about all this. He said the warning lights are blinking red when it comes to protecting against Russian interference in our electoral process and in our infrastructure. Does that concern you at all as someone who's charged with protecting the security of the vote in Clay County? You've got federal officials saying, look, this is real. This is happening. We've got to guard against it.
You know, Florida elections professionals have always taken security seriously, and that's security, whether it's physical security, computer security, or cybersecurity. We do take that charge seriously. And I think that we live in an environment with online connected services and distributed in the cloud and whatnot. It's a threat that's real. I think that people would be surprised just to the attempts to gain access in individuals' home networks if they ever took the time to look at the logs of attempts to come into those networks. So we are guarded. I think that that was one of the most significant things to where in the state of Florida, when we joined the multi-state information sharing and analysis center, because we have all of this information that's coming in, and it's almost kind of like noise. But once you take and analyze that information and start seeing some trends, then you can begin to protect against that.
The signal and the noise, right? I think that's the famous expression. Yeah.
Exactly. We had a caller respond to Jack's question, a new resident of Florida, where do you go to find information on the candidates? And one of the callers offered up, look for your political party county executive committees. Sometimes they meet and have candidates in from both parties, and they can communicate with those candidates. So it certainly takes some time and takes some dedication to go out and find that information. Chris, let me ask you, as a supervisor of elections in a county in Florida, here in the 2018 election, what are you doing differently? What is your technology doing differently in 2018 than 2016?
Well, I think the first thing, whenever there's a potential of a threat, you need to diagnose what exactly and where those vulnerabilities are. So one of the first things that we did is we partnered with Homeland Security. And because elections was created as one of the critical infrastructures, that's really allowed Homeland Security to provide a ton of resources, not only to the state, but to the counties. Mm-hmm. So some of those resources are, we conducted what was called a risk vulnerability assessment. and that's for 2 weeks to where they attempted a penetration of our networks. So I believe that first we wanted to see what the weaknesses are. We receive a cyber hygiene analysis on a weekly basis.
What did all this work, though, conclude, though? I mean, as we're you know, on the eve of another primary vote here, 2 years after the 16 election, what's different for Clay County?
What it tells us is that our networks are extremely secure and that we continue to be proactive on any upcoming threat.
And so if you saw, you have the technology, in other words, to detect if someone's trying to probe into your system. You can detect that and you can wall them out.
And new threats emerge on a daily basis. And so we're continually taking and looking at that data and analyzing it, making sure that we're protected and patched for any new threat.
It's the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition here on Florida Public Radio. Well, guys, it's certainly not a boring, sleepy summer primary this year, is it? AG, it's you're working 7 days a week covering these candidates.
27-6.
Things are hopping, aren't they?
They're going to keep hopping, and they're going to hop into the general. It's an unprecedented year for interest in Florida politics, for money in Florida politics, and for messaging. It's ground zero.
It really is. Yeah. It's been that way for ever since election night 2000, and it just keeps becoming more intense, Tom.
It does.
It's really incredible to watch.
We're running out of time, but let's get to as many calls as we can here to hear around the state here. Lots of engagement in Pompano Beach, South Florida. Susan, you are on the radio. Thanks for your patience. Go ahead. Make it quick for us. Susan, you with us still?
I'm right here. Yes. Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Loud and clear.
My question regarding the five candidates in the Democratic on the Democratic Party running for governor is, do you have any indication of the popularity of each candidate in the area, in the region that they come from? For example, Mr. Gillum is from Tallahassee.
Sure.
How popular is he there?
Well,
Graham is from some panhandle region.
We're real quick on tight, Susan. We get the question here. AG, I'd offer that, you know, Phil Levine was elected mayor in Miami Beach twice. Andrew Gillum has been elected as mayor in Tallahassee. That shows certainly some level of local interest.
The smart campaigns are doing regional polling and they're calibrating their messages accordingly. I mean, obviously, they're strongest where they come from.
Sure. And thank you so much, A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics, and Chris Chambliss. He is the supervisor of elections for Clay County, working hard to protect your vote. Gentlemen, so good to have your insights on the Florida Roundup this Friday. Thank you so much for being on the show and spending an hour here with us in studio. We really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, finally this hour, Tom, it is the end of a year-long battle over a house in Mount Dora, Central Florida, that had been painted to look like Vincent van Gogh's famous The Starry Night. All right. Nancy Nemhauser and Lubomir Jastrzecki, who live in the house, have been embroiled in this big feud with the city of Mount Dora, just north of Orlando. They wanted to keep their interpretation of Van Gogh's masterpiece on their home and the wall around it. But the city had fined them for this big, splashy mural.
Yeah, more than just a mural, right? I mean, you've seen pictures and video of this. This was something to behold. This was not the side of their house. This was their entire house that was done up to look like this, right? Well, all of this finally ended on Tuesday this week with an apology and an agreement to drop thousands of dollars in fees and fines against these homeowners. Now, the dispute of all of this began back in July last summer when the couple decided to make over a dingy wall around their property. It was inspired to commission the mural they decided as kind of a beacon for their adult son, and it grew into the entire house. Their adult son has autism, and they figured that in the event he got lost, he'd be able to tell people where he lived and find the house easily.
Right. No one can mistake this Starry Night house anywhere in town. So I guess that argument finally won the day. It seems Mount Dora officials have dropped their position that this bright blue background and the swirling yellow stars that Van Gogh made so iconic, well, they dropped their argument that it violated the local sign ordinance. So the Starry Night house stays. If you're in Mount Dora, you should go take a look at it, I guess.
Absolutely. That is our program for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami.
Kevin Murchard is our show producer. Jason Zabka is our technical director. WLRN's program director is Peter Mayertz.
And our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll see you next week.